Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 224, A New Sinai. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are here one day early because it is the eve of the holiday of Shavuot. Tonight, the holiday of Shavuot begins, and I'm about to give Lex an opportunity to tell us a little bit about what we have planned. But before I do, I just want to note, as we always do in these episodes that are just a conversation between Lex and me, that we really invite and we need your help. We've been actually putting some calls out for help of a variety of ways in the last few weeks, and it's been amazing to have people respond. I just want to apologize to some of the people. I think by now, hopefully, I've gotten back to all of you, but it's overwhelming in a wonderful way that people have stepped up and said, I want to be a captain of 10. I want to get involved in some of this creativity stuff that we've talked about over the last few weeks. So we're I'll put another call out there. If you're one of those people who wants to be kind of a volunteer organizer, you're somebody who's able to work at that level, that would be really helpful to us right now. So let me just say briefly that what we usually say, which is there's another kind of support that we need, and absolutely we need that more than ever, because now we're running two big projects, Judaism Unbound and Jewish Live, and we could really use your financial help to keep those projects going. We've had some amazing financial support from a lot of organizations, including the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, as well as the Lippman Kamfer Foundation, which has given us some amazing grants that have allowed us to get Jewish Live off the ground. But we still are looking for a broad base of support from all of those who are listening to Judaism Unbound and using Jewish Live. And we're not asking for a lot. We're really hoping that maybe every time you watch a show on Jewish Live or you listen to an episode of Judaism Unbound, that you maybe think of that as a dollar dropping into the little bank account that you're going to send to us. And maybe that means $18 a year. Maybe that means $50 a year. Maybe that means $180 a year. But whatever you're able to give, we're extremely grateful for. And I want to assure you that A, we need it, and B, we'll use it well. So thank you so much. The way that you can do that is to go to www.judaismunbound.com/donate or www.jewishlive.org/donate. And we're really, again, super grateful for all the help that you can give. So now let's jump into our program. Lex, before we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about today, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what we've got cooked up for Shavuot and why we're releasing this episode a day early, in part so that you'll know before it happens.
Heck yeah. Okay, so Shavuot Live. There's a few pieces that we need to answer. One, what is Shavuot, which I'll do really briefly, and two, what is Shavuot Live, which is our initiative for Shavuot. Okay, so first, Shavuot is a holiday that rolls around each year, Jewishly. It comes 7 weeks after the holiday of Passover, and it commemorates a variety of things and sort of a different set of things depending on where we are in Jewish history, because it's changed a bunch. But roughly, it commemorates the moment of the receiving of Ten Commandments, or sort of receiving the Torah entirely at Mount Sinai in the Exodus narrative. And one of the traditions that's evolved over time is that you stay up all night doing learning of some kind or another. Now, there's certain books that have traditionally been prioritized that folks like to dive into on Shavuot, the Book of Ruth, for example, the text of Pirkei Avot, which is from the Talmud. But we're sort of opening up Pandora's box and encouraging you to do all sorts of different kinds of learning, of maybe some text, but also some non-text. So for 24 hours, yes, 24 hours, we are going to be offering live streaming digital Jewish learning. So starting 5 p.m. tonight, Thursday, May 28th, through, and that's Eastern time, through 5 p.m. the 29th, tomorrow, Friday, we'll be having just nonstop rolling programming through our Jewish Live Facebook page and through our website. And you can follow everything at jewishlive.org/Shavuot. That's S-H-A-V-U-O-T. And I'm super stoked about this. One thing I want to say right away before it gets lost is not only are we going to be featuring some really great teachers and facilitators of Jewish learning. We're going to be featuring people. As we record this, we've confirmed 4 different continents, I believe. We may have 6 different continents, which is to say every continent that is not Antarctica. We may have people presenting from all of those as part of this 24-hour extravaganza.
Wait, I'm working on a few penguins.
Yes, so. we're going to get some penguins. It's going to be awesome. But just earlier today, I was having an email thread with a lovely friend of the podcast in Australia. There's folks that have stepped up. There's somebody who stepped up in Africa. There's a few folks in Europe. I mean, it's a very cool thing that we're putting together here. And one thing I'm especially proud of is we're mixing. So there's some folks that you'll be familiar with who are past guests on our podcast, some really incredible folks. But we've also reached out to some folks that we've been talking about as sort of everyday Jews. Jews in the pews, Jews maybe not in the pews. And we're excited to be incorporating some of those people. So friends of ours that we've made in Britain will be participating. Friends of ours that I've made through Jewish Facebook will be presenting. Just a whole slew of interesting folks. So we hope that you'll tune in. And that's what we'll be offering starting tonight at 5 p.m. Eastern.
So I wanted to start our conversation today jumping off from Shavuot as a concept and as a mythic concept, and then trying to take it into what we've been talking about, because I actually think the Shavuot marks a moment, actually in some ways, 2 moments, arguably, that are really important in the mythology of Judaism. Specifically, that Shavuot marks the day upon which the Ten Commandments were given. And I'm not sure, actually, Lex, does it mark the beginning of the 40 days that Moses goes up to Mount Sinai, or the end of the 40 days? Must be the beginning.
I think the beginning, but that's a good question. We can look into it.
Yeah, must be the beginning. Well, it must be the beginning on 2 levels, right? Because 40 days is almost the entire period of the Omer, the 49 days. And I know they didn't get to Mount Sinai in 9 days, I'm pretty sure. So that's number one. And number two, I guess that really it's the giving of the 10 commandments, which ostensibly happened early on in the 40 days. And then I don't know what Moses was doing the rest of the 40 days, but apparently, you know, I guess it takes a long time to write the Torah. But the other thing that happens at that period is the golden calf. And, you know, so they may not be happening on the same day of Shavuot, but at least if we think about Shavuot as the annual day in which we mark the moment of the Sinai moment, and it's not just the giving of the Torah, it's also the creation of the golden calf. I'm not totally sure where we want to take that. We've had a lot of interesting spins on the golden calf story over the years on Judaism Unbound, including all kinds of ways to look at it in a more positive light, or at least in a more realistic light about what it means to build a golden calf and why people might be impelled to do that. So I just want to point out that I think that both of those pieces are in play and they have connections between them. But in terms of where we are in the story this year in particular, where we've been using this metaphor to talk about how the COVID-19 has made us have an exodus from the way that we knew Judaism before, and now we've been in this wilderness, whether it's the digital wilderness or the larger wilderness of a migration to a new kind of Judaism that we don't know yet, that there's this moment relatively early on where maybe you can see it as a stock-taking moment, as an intense stock-taking moment. I mean, we've been taking stock here on Jewish Live and on Judaism Unbound from the beginning, but I'm thinking about, you know, well, maybe there's a certain moment that comes when you realize, hey, actually, everything that we've been experiencing so far in the wilderness, it's not clear exactly how that affects the future, right? Meaning, so let me give you just one example. I've stopped going to digital synagogue. I've stopped. It's 8 weeks into it. I have reverted to my previous self that I don't like going to synagogue. And there was this time where I really, you know, was into it in terms of the digital synagogue. By the way, no offense to my synagogue. They're still doing a great job. I actually think they're doing a great job. But what I found is that I didn't really have a natural interest in synagogue services. And the first few weeks, there was a certain novelty. There was also a certain desire to be with a community, or to have a sense of at least a curiosity to see what was going on with this community. And I've been like really pretty happy about what's going on. And now I kind of feel like, well, I wasn't going there before. Why am I going there now? And it's not because, I should point out that the synagogue is two blocks from my house. The reason why I wasn't going to synagogue before was not that it was a strain for me to get there. It was that it's just not my thing. And it makes me think more broadly about the idea that, you know, hey, maybe there's going to be this kind of initial set of things that happens in the trauma of the Exodus, and maybe those things point to the future, and maybe they don't. But we can't necessarily know just based on the fact that they're happening. So, you know, that's one thing that's really on my mind is saying, okay, so now that we can take stock, let's look back at what has happened since the Exodus. But at the same time, let's actually look at it thoughtfully and carefully and say, just because everybody was, you know, just because synagogue services were up for a while on digital and maybe still are up, that doesn't necessarily mean, hey, people love digital synagogue. That's the future of synagogue. You know, but then the question is, well, what does it mean? Where are you sitting, Lex?
I'm sitting a few places. One, I really am finding myself super excited for Shavuot. So first off, I'll start by saying, and maybe this surprises folks who have followed us close enough to know our like respective personalities and tendencies, I also have not been going to digital services very much. I don't go to services weekly, sort of pre-COVID. I haven't gone to services weekly, but I do go sometimes. And I have been going rarely. And the times, and if I'm being honest, I don't know whether to feel good about this or bad about this. The times I've been going are when I'm leading, like when I myself am like centered, which maybe that doesn't reflect so well on me that I only go when I get to be in charge. But like I have enjoyed thoroughly leading in this context, specifically because the places I've been leading have not been starting from a rubric of, oh, this is what we do pre-COVID, and so we're going to sort of do our best to replicate that, simulate that. We're usually in like a 2.5 hour service, and we've been maxing it at 60 minutes. So it's like, okay, you're going to do your shortest version. And so I've done that, and I've played around with like various visual kinds of modalities using images, etc., virtual backgrounds, all that stuff. It's been fun. But the reason I bring that up is because I'm excited for Shavuot because I feel like this is a holiday that does actually work for digital modalities in a way that I think others are hard. At least like the version that we've been operating with is a good map, because Shavuot's about learning. And one thing, I don't know if we've said this explicitly, but I've sort of gleaned it over the last couple months, is like learning works digitally pretty well. Like a good teacher can teach digitally without making so many, I mean, you want to know the technology, you want to be able to make shifts, whatever, but like I think it's an easier thing to do than other kinds of meaning making. And I think that this is like the annual moment where you really just, those of us who are big on the learning side, that's something I do all the time. Even if I'm not going to services, I am participating daily in forms of Jewish learning through Facebook, whatever, before and after COVID. Like, this is our time. And I think that it hasn't surprised me that we've seen, in addition to our own initiative, just a lot of different Shavuot events popping up digitally. Before this, I really didn't know, outside of the biggest metropolitan areas, very few spaces actually did all-night Shavuot events. That people would do, you know, an hour or two thing a little later at night, you know, maybe 8 to 10 p.m. There's an event that brings some folks together. And in the biggest metropolitan areas, there's been, you know, cross-denominational collaborations. But like typical spaces, I don't think have really done much with this holiday. And I'm finding that there's just sort of option after option after option happening now, because I think there's this craving. I think people are like, oh, this is one we can really do. It's not about singing together, which is hard digitally. It's not about prayer, which I think even that without the singing is hard. It's just learning, which you can do that. You really can.
So is it about craving, or is it about, meaning is it about the demand side, or is it about the supply side, right? I mean, is it that people are craving it, or is it that it's doable?
I am going to dodge and say a little bit that it's both. I think that there is, so I'm not going to claim that there's a craving among everybody. I think that's important. And so I know one piece you want to talk about is the difference between sort of the folks who are on the inside of Jewish learning versus folks who might never have experienced Shavuot or heard of Shavuot. I do think there is a large cohort, and I've thought this for a number of years. I think Shavuot's stock has been going up. If we were going to like, and part of me cringes at this idea, but like if we were going to sort of look at the rise and fall of various rituals and holidays and whatever Jewishly, I think Shavuot the last decade or so has drastically increased. I myself am somebody who did not grow up with the holiday, and I observed it for the first time in college. I know a ton of people of many different ages who did not observe Shavuot for many decades, and then within the last 5 to 10 years have started to engage with it every year. So, I haven't done any studies on it, but I feel pretty confident that it's trending upward. And I think it relates to a set of dynamics where like there is this craving. I think there is a really large group of people that we sometimes underestimate who like love Jewish nerddom. Like love diving into text, and even, I mean, sometimes traditional text, sometimes less traditional text, but like really want to geek out about this corpus of Jewish tradition and history. And Shavuot as literally a glorified all-nighter, like it's an all-nighter. Like it's something that theoretically college students don't want to do, but do once or twice in order to prep for the big exam. But like there's people that really love this. And, a few years ago when I said Shavuot was my favorite holiday, I'd get these weird looks. And now when I say Shavuot's my favorite holiday, I still get some weird looks, but I get fewer of them from people sort of regularly engaged in Jewish learning. But I do want to name also that I'm under no illusions that like people who don't set foot in synagogue, who don't look for Jewish immersion that regularly are going to like, ah, Shavuot, like I'm going to dive in now. I think it's not a holiday I see as well geared towards like a 101. I think it's much more of a 301 or a 401. Mm-hmm. And maybe that like, for me, maybe that's okay. I just think we should know that's what it is and not treat it in the way that we might treat a Passover or a Rosh Hashanah, which like there are a lot more people sort of jumping aboard that are not looking to other holidays the rest of the year.
Right. Well, because that's interesting, because when you say like Shavuot is an all-nighter, I mean, there are already so many assumptions in that, right? That even if somebody knows like that there's a somewhat traditional, it's actually of more recent vintage than I think most people that do it think, but somewhat of a tradition of staying up all night studying Torah on Shavuot. Why? There's all kinds of, you know, Kabbalistic spiritual reasons for it. And there's, you could also say that it tracks the Sinai moment, right? The idea that people were up all night for some reason relating to the time when Moses received the Ten Commandments at Sinai. There are all kinds of explanations, but there's this kind of practice, that, at least for the last few hundred years, of staying up all night to study. What I think is interesting, so we could say, well, that's a 301 level because, you know, you have to already have some familiarity with even this practice exists, you know, and also some degree of interest in staying up all night studying a Jewish topic. You know, I guess what I'm suggesting is that either we probably need to give a new valence to it to say, like, we have a practice staying up all night studying. Can we find a new explanation for why that registers in a more powerful way for folks, right? Like, so for example, this is our one day a year where in this time of Jewish upheaval in an intense and worldwide way, we can try to put our heads together and try to think in new ways about Judaism, right? Now, if we were doing that, it may or may not lead to the same type of activities, you know, where it's traditionally, you know, in the way synagogues and other organizations do it, it's like, well, in the way I think in some ways we're doing it, you take it, somebody takes an hour and they lead a session and then you go to the next session, you know, as opposed to some kind of think tank process where we're really, you know, getting through a big idea over the course of the night and by morning, you know, maybe something more like a hackathon, you know, and maybe a Shavuot Jewish hackathon would make more sense for the time that we live in rather than a more traditional Shavuot study, at least for the 101 level, right? And I like what you're talking about, that the more, you know, people that are into it, the people that are already doing the hackathon every day, like we are, you know, might say, okay, well, I don't need to do a hackathon on Shavuot because I do the hackathon every day. So what I need to do on Shavuot is a really intense deep dive into a topic. I don't know. There are all kinds of ways that I could imagine kind of reinventing the practice of Shavuot a little bit to suit the times that we're in. You know, but my question always is whether sometimes with these things where, you know, where it's a solution in search of a problem or vice versa, you know, and how do we really do some of that? Well, I want to note, by the way, that we don't really have time. I mean, we sort of, in theory, had time if we started the day that the COVID-19 physical distancing started, but we didn't because Passover was coming. You know, in some ways, there isn't time to absolutely reinvent a holiday in a very brief period of time. I'm really interested. So that's a little bit what I was trying to say about how you have this initial kind of shock of the change, and then you have this long period. And maybe that long period in the wilderness is good and important because it actually takes a long time to reinvent some of this stuff, not for the time of the shock, but for the time that is going to be in our future. And I wonder, I'm really excited to know about Shavuot for next year, you know, for example. Like, I think that we'll have plenty of time to really, like, think that one through. Let's make a note that we should actually start working on that, you know, right after Sukkot, maybe.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things coming up for me. One, I do believe that the all-night aspect of Shavuot is potentially powerful. And I think, like, I when I talk about Shavuot, you're right that I have used, like, an is tense and not a has been tense in the sense we often do, where, like, we talk about holidays have been X and could be Y or Z in the future. And I do think that there's something really amazing about just staying up all night. Like, it doesn't need to be learning, but, like, I think the fact of staying up all night is for me a really powerful thing, even if you're not exactly sure why. Like, so you talked about how maybe it's a think tank, maybe it's a hackathon. My instinct is, like, if the goal is that, like, the 7 weeks preparing is like a longer period of time. So the 7 weeks of the Omer between Passover and Shavuot feels like a better way to really do the instrumental kinds of work. So, like, work for the sake of the future. Like, we are trying to come up with ideas and remap Judaism. Like, that feels like a 7 week every year, really, really intensive kind of process. To me, I do kind of sense a magic in one night that is just like learning is great without a goal. Like, I think that it's just like, this is a holiday for the group of people who are nerdy and, like, interested. And honestly, part of me thinks that if we explicitly made this holiday one that was like that, it would allow other holidays to be more of what we want in terms of actually really, really making them so that they're, like, beginner friendly, not centering those who always come, instead thinking about how we can remap for Judaism 3.0, Judaisms of the future, et cetera. Like, if there was one holiday, and to me, Shavuot strikes as one that might work, that was really like, okay, this is like institutional memory day. We're going to learn the texts that have been around a long time. We're going to dive into them. We're going to, of course, think about new ways that they can map onto our world. But, like, there's kind of not a goal. Like, it's just, we love learning. And then the rest of the year is, it's almost like I think of Tisha B'Av, like the holiday of the fast of Av, where you, like, sort of place all of the massive amount of Jewish catastrophe and mourning onto one day. Because if you didn't do that, I feel like the entire rest of the year would be imbued with a huge amount of catastrophe and mourning. So, like, you choose a day where you get it on the calendar, and then the rest of the year can be devoted to other things. So I'm curious if that lands well on you, or if you still want to push.
Well, I want to go to a new topic, basically, but I would say that I have mixed feelings about it. I liked the last thing you said registered a lot to me. The idea that if you don't pour all of this stuff on one day, then it gets spread out over the whole rest of the time and it gets in the way. I totally agree with that. But that was a little bit in contrast to the more positive valence that you had about Shavuot as, like, the holiday for nerds. And my question was going to be for that, like, but what about those who are not nerds? Like, does that mean that they shouldn't celebrate this holiday because maybe people don't want to do that? You know, and maybe the answer is sure. sure, you know, like you don't have to celebrate every holiday. You know, I don't know. But I mean, I guess like, and I was also thinking about it sort of the reverse of the way that you described it and saying, what if the 7 weeks could be the time for learning and the one day of Shavuot would be the hackathon? You know, like I think that there's a lot, and I'm not arguing in favor of one or the other. What I'm suggesting is that in the, you know, few minutes that we've been discussing this, I feel like a lot of really interesting possibilities have started to emerge. And my question is kind of like, where is the process for figuring that out, right? And I think that the answer probably is some version of eventually prototyping all of these ideas and seeing which one has legs, you know, which one gets adopted. And just by virtue of the way these things go, especially if we're talking about an annual holiday, we're probably talking about a few years of having to go through and say, hey, there is no traditional practice for Shavuot. We're prototyping lots of ideas. And what does the process look like for prototyping those ideas and getting to those possibilities and putting them into action? And then, you know, we could artificially do a Shavuot every 3 months or something like that to try to do some rapid prototyping. I'm not sure if that would work or not, you know, but if it's going to be once a year, then it's probably going to take quite a few years until we kind of get it. And so that connects to a few things. One is that I love that idea, right? Meaning like I love the idea and I understand that it's not for everybody and that people want stability. And I don't know exactly what the answer is for those folks. I guess what I'm saying is that I love the idea that for the next, let's say, 10 years, there would be no normative Jewish practice. Now, that's already the case in many respects. You know, people just don't admit it. So I would like to admit it, that we don't know how to be Jewish the right way for the next 10 years. And it's all experimental. So I want to shift gears a little bit to a question of just to talk a little bit about theory again, because again, the theory is what really anchors some of this possibility. So I want to talk about the innovator's dilemma and the basic idea that we're talking about all this innovation. Why hasn't this innovation happened before? You know, and the answer is that it has. It's tended to happen outside of the basic large structures of the Jewish community. And just to real quick say the theory of why that is that large organizations tend to be held back in their innovation, and even more important than their innovation, their implementation of the innovation, because their happy customers don't allow those innovations to be implemented. That's the innovator's dilemma, that a synagogue may well have a great idea for some absolutely new way that we do Shabbat, but they're never going to really implement it because the people who come every week for the regular service who've been coming for the last 50 years are going to be too angry that the services were canceled. They're not going to let that happen. And so the synagogue never has the resources to really put a new alternative idea on the ground in a serious way. That's basically the innovator's dilemma. And I think what we're seeing here now is the breaking of an innovator's dilemma in a very unusual way, right? Because the innovator's dilemma is usually solved by innovation happening outside of the centers of the old system. But when there's a destruction level event, like the destruction of the temple or the coronavirus, in my view, what you have is a new situation where there are no happy customers anymore. By definition, nobody can be a happy customer because everything that the happy customers knew and loved is gone. And the question is, what opportunity does that lead to radically rethink? And this brings me back, Lex, to the what I was trying to say about the digital services. It's like, I think that my response to the digital services at this point, 8 weeks in, is that they're not different enough. And they're kind of trying to answer the needs, the desires of those previously happy customers. And that's a missed opportunity for synagogues. And it's a missed opportunity for all of us if we try to replicate in some fashion the in-person Jewish experiences online. And I think that that's the natural thing to do if you think this is a short-term situation and you think you're going back to the way things were when it ends. I'm wondering if we reframe that and say, well, at least hypothetically, let's imagine that we're not going back to those institutions because they're not going to make it. And this is going to last longer than we thought it was, which feels to me in many ways like it is. And we've been saying that all along. But then would we think very differently? What would we be doing during this time to actually experiment with radically new ways of experiencing Judaism beyond what's currently going on? And can we try to sort of think through some of that?
But what I'm sitting with is like the extent to which things have been broken and haven't been broken. I think one takeaway, I don't know if it's an optimistic or a pessimistic takeaway of this moment, is that like even when just about everything about institutions is broken, I think we're seeing a resilience and like an ability to not fully face that reality that is astonishing.
Yep.
So we're continuing, and there is a way in which it's impressive, right? Like, okay, so we can't be in pews together. We can't be in a shared space together. We can't do singing together. We can't, and like, still, we're going to start from the point of like Shabbat service, like, as opposed to, okay, we're going to throw that, like, we can't do Shabbat services, we're going to do a different thing. Like, there's a way in which that's impressive and resilient, and I don't want to dismiss that. There's also a way in which you could just frame it as stubborn. And I think it's both. I think it's on each one of us to sort of see it however we see it. I'm thinking of like the blue and black dress, the white and gold dress whole situation. Like, it's both. It's just each person sees it either as stubborn or as resilient. And I think for me, there's a way in which it's stubborn. And more than stubborn, it's missing the picture, which is that there's a huge group that will never be attracted at all to any option whose starting point is what existed before. And that includes people who are like deeply into various facets of Jewish tradition. Like, there's just a large and I think growing group of people who are bored. I think that that's really huge. And the prototyping piece really does feel like the only solution. But then it's like, I don't know, the process of getting people on board to do the prototyping. I mean, it's in many ways like what our entire goal has been of this podcast for a long time. But like, it's huge and astronomically challenging. And I think even of there was a recent article I read by Yehuda Kurtzer, who, you know, past guest on the show, like somebody who we deeply respect, that was arguing basically the solution right now to high holidays is to have a ton of groups of 10 people still gather and train a ton of people to lead those services who have never led services before in a relatively traditional way instead of digital. And to me, like, once again, with deep respect to Yehuda Kurtzer, like, I couldn't think that's more foundationally wrong. Like, it to me, that represents every form of like, okay, high holidays are toasted. And as opposed to acknowledging that and saying it's just not going to look like it did before, we're going to try and train thousands of people in a few months who have never done this before and gather small groups. By the way, we don't even know if gatherings of 10 will be permissible, but like, let's say it was, like, it feels like such a move of like, no, this is going to be as close to the same as possible, that I really want us to be less stubborn than I'm going to use that word again. Like, I want us to err on the side of thinking new.
It's such an interesting framing. Like, another one of our friends and people that we very much respect, David Zvi Kalman, wrote a piece on Facebook the other day, sort of ranking the holidays based on how difficult they would be to replicate in social distancing times. And he wasn't really he wasn't expressing explicitly an opinion one way or the other about any of what we're talking about. But I responded to it by saying, that all depends on what you mean by replicating the traditional holidays or whatever, you know, because my point was that these holidays themselves were reinvented during the previous time of upheaval, and they were reinvented in the previous time of upheaval before that. And so the idea that, and I'm not sure, and I don't know that you can say based on any current way that the holiday looks, whether it's difficult or hard. It's more about the question of what is that holiday capable of doing going forward? But it's interesting. But I mean, to go back to Yehuda's point that you were talking about, when you think about the gargantuan amount of investment, I don't mean financial investment, I just mean investment of time and effort that it would take to train all of these people to lead high holiday services, even if that were possible. Imagine using that same amount of time and effort to reinvent 42,000 different prototypes, or even just 42. You know, that's the life, the universe, and everything, right? You know, the idea that you could really engage in that process. And the question is, why would you prefer one over the other? And again, I'm not ascribing this to Yehuda. I don't know what his preferences and what his thoughts are. But why would one prefer one over the other? I think you might say, well, number one, we of course would have to do the training of people to lead High Holiday services traditionally if we believe that somehow that is the only right way to do High Holidays, right? It's from God, or there's some way that that's the only thing that means the High Holidays. That's possibility one. Possibility number two, we think that we're going to go back to the way things were when this is done. So this is just a temporary interregnum period. Maybe it's 1 year, maybe it's two at the most, you know, and that if we could just get through this, then we'll be okay on the other end of it. And, you know, maybe there's some others. And the alternative point of view is this is the beginning of a future. And it's not at all clear that that future involves High Holiday services as we've known them in any way. And or that even if we wanted it to, when we go back after this is over, it's not going to be the same. The institutions are not going to be there. You know, the other piece of it is that I think Yehuda's idea is really maybe not bad for people who themselves love High Holiday services, and they just absolutely love them, and they want to have them. That I don't have any problem at all with those folks getting together and replicating High Holiday services in groups of 10, if that's allowed.
And safe. Yeah.
And safe. That's what I mean. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Of course. And safe. Very, and we should talk about this at some point, because there's a lot of talk that even if things were to be allowed, we shouldn't do them anyway because they're not safe. But the other thing is that a lot of people don't like High Holiday services, and they only go if they, I mean, a lot of people don't go. A lot of the people who go only go because that's what's available, and they feel like they should be doing something, and there's no energy to create an alternative, or and if there is, they haven't heard about it. And so the question is, if you pour all of the efforts of the community into training these High Holiday service leaders for groups of 10 and don't pour any effort into anything else, then those people are still back where we started, which is that there's nothing for them. They're not going to go to the synagogue, and they're not going to go to these small groups. The piece, though, that I want to say, and I think this is going to be controversial to say this way, but I want to bring in the golden calf, because I've been thinking a lot about the golden calf lately and thinking about what does it mean. And now I'm not totally sure about early Israelite religious practices in Egypt, if the Israelites really were slaves in Egypt and whatever. And I don't know that anybody knows. But in my imagination, one of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of when they created a golden calf, my sense is that they created a golden calf because that's what they knew religion to be. And so here they are after the Exodus, they get to Mount Sinai, and there's some sense that God is about to declare this new religion, this new way to be an Israelite. And their response to it is, I think, in the golden calf, is to say, no, we'd rather go back to the old way. And I think that if we see the golden calf not the way that we've been taught it, which is a bad innovation and a bad attempt to bring in some foreign worship. But if we see it in a little bit more of a charitable way, and we say, no, 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 that's not what it is at all. It's an attempt to reclaim the old way of being Jewish because the new way is too scary or unknown or unfamiliar. And if we look at it that way, then is the attempt to hold on to the previous way of being Jewish that we knew and, by the way, did not love. And so we are going to hold on to that for dear life at a time specifically where we have an opportunity to explore something else, something that takes as seriously the content and the raw material of Judaism, but allows us to put it together in a new way, allows us to connect across geography, allows us to put together the hopes and aspirations of all the people who were never coming to that stuff in the first place, but are now giving it a second look because they're lonely and they're looking for something and they're open, and we're going to just double down on the old stuff? Shame on us. That's the golden calf.
I want to close just by focusing to two groups of people that maybe you're listening. Maybe these are people who don't listen to us, but like, I don't know. To me, there's two groups that are sort of proverbially connecting to or worshiping the golden calf you just described. So two groups of people that I think are worth naming. One is people who look at COVID-19 and all of the upheaval right now Jewishly, and they know that it's not going to be the same afterwards. They know it's going to be different, but they think it shouldn't be. Like, ultimately, they think that automatically, whatever, like, product, I hate that word, but, like, whatever Judaism is going to inhabit the other side is going to be worse. So that's people who, like, descriptively do recognize a change is happening, but prescriptively would like it not to be happening. Then there's a second group, which I think actually is not recognizing that there is a change happening, is actually just saying, like, no, this is fully temporary, and what's the moment we're in is done. We're going to go back to normal. And that group of people, I can't really convince of anything. Like, we see things differently, but I would strongly ask that if you are one of those people that really thinks that this is temporary, that in a year or in 2 years, both you and I, on different sides of this argument, like, really sit down and look out at the grand scheme of what's going on Jewishly and really evaluate if that was the case. Because it would thoroughly stun me if we actually are not deeply changed collectively as a result of this moment, whatever we want. So for the first group, I think, like, there's a longer conversation for us to have because we both recognize that there's a serious change afoot right now, and it's just a matter of whether that's good or not. Like, with that group of people, I would love to have many, many conversations with you about the beauties of digital connection, of the potentials that we have when we really unlock the different possibilities. Also, what you always talk about, how we're still very early and what we can do today is not necessarily what we'll be able to do digitally in 10 years or 50 years, and it might be so much bigger and better. Like, I understand that first group, because there's an impulse in all of us to say what we know is better than what we don't yet know. But for the second group, who really doesn't think that there's a serious change underfoot, that this is just a little blip, I hope that we can revisit in a couple years and sort of check in, because I think there's serious like, one of us is wrong, right. and we have to be able to really, because we are all interested in the future of this Jewish project, and we have to be willing to put aside our own our own initial impulses, intuitions, and evaluate what the case is. And so I'll say that, like, once again, if I'm wrong, I will do this. Right. I will rethink. But
right, yeah. I absolutely agree, and I want to reinforce one thing, which is that my concern here is for the vast majority of Jews. I have no problem with somebody who wants to do something in their own life, in their own practice, that doesn't appeal to me or to other Jews. That's totally fine. My concern is that if those folks are the leaders of our institutions, of the institutions of Jewish life, they should not delude themselves and others into believing that they are serving the majority of Jews by failing to take this moment as a moment for serious rethinking and experimentation and prototyping. And I totally agree with you, and I'm totally with you that I want to have this conversation in a year, in a few years, to see who is right. And I think it's been clear what my cards are, but I want to be really clear that I'm willing to be judged on that question. But I think that it would be a terrible shame and a terrible wasted opportunity to fail to fully invest in the potential to create a new Judaism that people have been yearning for 200 years when the time presents itself, when there is a destruction level event. And I'll tell you that I came into this conversation a little more optimistic than I'm leaving it, not about what's going to happen, but about the capacity of institutional players to do it. Because I came into the conversation trying to say that there's a great opportunity here, that a destruction presents an opportunity to break the innovator's dilemma in an unusual way, which is to embrace the idea that there are no happy customers, and therefore we can move the work of innovation closer into the core than usually happens in the world of disruptive innovation. But I'm walking out of the conversation a little bit thinking that that's a pipe dream, that the priests are not the people who developed rabbinic Judaism even after the destruction of the Second Temple. There weren't too many priests and Sadducees involved in that process. And that maybe at the end of the day, realistically, that the destruction doesn't actually matter that much, except insofar as it tells the people out in the periphery, don't look to the center for your solutions because there is no center anymore. And maybe that's the optimistic valence on it that says, if we want to focus on the vast majority of Jews who have not ever been involved in the institutional infrastructure of American Jewish life from the time there was an American Jewish life, but who have nevertheless carried out a rich Jewish life on their own with Passover Seders, with Hanukkah, with all kinds of evidence that they aspire to make Judaism something that's part of their lives, but they're not coming to synagogue, they're not coming to JCCs, they're not coming, they're not giving to federations, they're not participating in the institutions of American Jewish life. And nevertheless, the Pew study shows us that they have high amounts of pride in being Jewish, and they think being Jewish is important in their lives. If those are all the people that are out there, this situation provides an opportunity to someone. And if the institutions are not going to be able to take it, then I hope somebody out there listening will, because there's a real openness, there's a real possibility now for entrepreneurs in this digital space. And the digital is only a tool to serve the post-geographic space. But the idea is that, look, I'll close my comments and then let you close off. But there is a statement in, I believe, Pirkei Avot, that says that is playing off, I believe, that's playing off the scene where Moses does something not necessarily so admirable, where he kills the Egyptian taskmaster who's oppressing one of the Israelites. We can argue whether that was admirable or not, but there's this comment that says, in a place where nobody is stepping up to be a leader, you should step up. It's put in gendered language, so I'm trying not to do that, but it says, in a place where there are no men, be a man.
I love that teaching, and the word of it, I'm sorry to be a nerd, but I said earlier in the episode I like being a nerd. So the Hebrew of it is gendered, very gendered. It says, be a man. It says, liyot ish. And all over the place, there's interesting, ish is the word for man. All over the place, there are texts that sort of look at that word ish and connect it to the word aish. So aish means fire. And I think that right now, not only should we be those leaders, should we be the people that we're not seeing around, but we should bring some fire. I think this conversation, we both got pretty passionate. Maybe that comes off negatively to folks, but I think we really do need that. I think it's important to recognize that, like, there are stakes here.
Yeah.
The book of Exodus starts with a fire. It's a fire that doesn't consume. These fires may or may not consume that we need to bring to our equation. But yeah, in a place that doesn't that isn't creating the Judaisms that we yearn for, let's be those Judaisms. Let's create those Judaisms.
Amen.
So with that,
amen,
we are going to close out this episode. We really do hope that you will join us later today, starting at 5 p.m. Eastern time. I can't list off all the time zones because it would literally be all of the worldwide time zones. But 5 p.m. Eastern is when our Shavuot Live will begin, and it will go until 5 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. That's the 29th of May. And if you're listening to this after either of those dates, we're gonna make sure to get recordings of the various sessions of Shavuot Live up on jewishlive.org/Shavuot, S-H-A-V-U-O-T, so that even if you're not there in real time, you can learn afterwards. So we're going to close out this episode in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our other Facebook page, Jewish Live. That's all one word. Third, you can go to either of our websites, jewishlive.org or judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can email us at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. As Dan mentioned at the top, we really do appreciate any amount of financial donation that you can send our way. And you can do that via jewishlive.org/donate or judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. Have a very happy Shavuot. Let's create some new Judaisms together. With that, this has been Judaism Unbound Live.